The words that we just heard read from Isaiah chapter 2 are famously inscribed at the entrance to the United Nations headquarters in New York City. And there's really a rather remarkable irony to this fact. Those words are there in large part because of the circumstances of historical contingency. The building is there, indeed, because of the historical contingencies of the moment. The United States, the dominant power in the world, it seemed logical to host the UN in New York. And the Rockefellers, believing in the cause of world peace, decided to buy the land on which the UN headquarters would be built. Now, I don't know how many of the diplomats who work there and visit there know this, but it might offer a little perspective for them to know that the place where they attend meetings and talk about great affairs of state was previously an abattoir. Turtle Bay in New York was undesirable real estate. Nobody wanted it. So the UN was built on bargain basement property. Then there are those words from Isaiah that are inscribed on the front. Considering how Israel is viewed and treated at the UN, it is really rather remarkable that the words of a Jewish prophet are at the front door. I cannot imagine those words being inscribed there today. But there they are. An aspiration, a hope for humanity. Now, we may look at these words and think they're lovely, they're beautiful, but they're so unrealistic. This notion of taking weapons and converting them into tools for productive civilian purpose. Isaiah was just a man with his head in the clouds. Unrealistic, not focused on the reality of life. Not true. Not true at all. Isaiah knew his way around the corridors of power. Isaiah was a high-ranking official in the court of the king of Judah. He knew politics. He knew power. And he lived at a time of great danger and peril for his people. The 8th century was a time of great turmoil. The Assyrian Empire, far in the east, was rising again, menacing its neighbors. And closer to home, the two little kingdoms next to Judah, Aram and Israel, got it in their heads that they were going to rebel against Assyrian power. But if they were going to be successful, they needed Judah to join. And the king of Judah wavered. He didn't think this was a particularly good idea, and Isaiah confirmed that. He argued against the alliance. The rebellion took place, though, and Judah was drawn in. Aram and Israel were utterly and totally destroyed, wiped from the face of the earth. And Judah was left a little rump state. It was that world that shaped these words we find in Isaiah's prophecies. And we don't even know if these are his words. You go read Micah chapter 4. You will see the exact same oracle. This is what in the trade is known as a floating oracle of peace. Now, Micah was prophesying also in the 8th century. So there was this vision, this hope abroad, this sense among some of the people of God that perhaps there was a different way to do things. And this notion, this sense, wasn't rooted in the abstract, but it was grounded in experience. Beat the swords into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks. We hear these words today, 100 years after the outbreak of the Great War. And we wonder, will this ever be possible? Can we ever do this? In fact, do we want to do this? It's so easy and appropriate for us to focus on the horrors of war, on the death and the destruction, the pointless killing. But so much of what we enjoy in our modern world is the product of war. You log on the internet last night or this morning to read the news or do some shopping, send an email to a loved one. You can thank the Defense Department. They're the ones who invented the internet. Planning to fly on a jet to see some relatives or friends at Thanksgiving or Christmas? Military aviation. Been following the saga of the probe to the comet this past week? This plucky little explorer going 300 million miles over 10 years? Amazing! Modern rocketry has its roots and its foundations in the Germans' desire to bomb people far, far away during World War II. Equal rights for women. The suffragette movement, in many ways, got its push over the finish line because of World War I. All those soldiers go off and fight. Someone has to work in the factories. And women showed they were just as capable as men. Empowerment and rose. War has shaped our world. But is war the only way for us to enjoy the fruits of progress? That is the question that is before us today. And 2,800 years ago, Isaiah said, no, it can't be. There has to be something else that we look to. We need to invest our hopes and our dreams somewhere else. We can't do it in the state or in ideologies or in politics. We need to look to God. When Isaiah says people are going to come to Zion, to Jerusalem, he's not saying that Judah is somehow going to become some world-dominating power. They're not coming to see the king, not the temporal one at least. He's talking about an acknowledgement of the peoples of the world that it is God who has created everything, who is in charge, who shapes us and makes us and forms us and gives us meaning. And when the people, when you and I live our lives in a way that reflects that reality, things change. Things happen. Peace can break out. Not the absence of war, and not life under a tyranny as a result of compromise, but true peace in which people can grow and flourish and be nurtured and build the kind of world God seeks for us. Now, I'm sure this all sounds just lovely and completely impossible to some folks here. How can I do any of this? Just me, one person. The world's so big, it's so complicated. Our faith teaches that individuals can make a difference. We've seen it with people like Martin Luther King. We saw it with Jesus. Indeed, people right here in Lebanon have made a difference. You think that folks here in the Upper Valley can't have an impact on the wider world? It's not true. Just a few weeks ago, a bunch of us went down to El Salvador. We built a house for a family. Small step, but it's a start. And it was kind of neat finding the toolbox that had been brought by the Tufts Engineers Without Border Group a few years earlier, still being used. Those are signs of the kingdom of God. And if you think, oh, well, yeah, that's great, but that's just the house, and that's not going to change the whole world. Well, you know, people from Lebanon, indeed from this church, have taken a place on the national stage. Some of you know this. In fact, some of you knew them. Our congregation can claim a governor and a United States senator among its members. Not shabby. A couple of guys. Norris Cotton, Lane Drunell, from here, Upper Valley. One of those kids downstairs today has the potential, the possibility to go out and change the world. To live in a time and a place where the swords are beaten into plowshares and the spears into pruning hooks. One of those kids downstairs may make that happen. It's our job to help that be a reality. Not just a possibility, but a reality. Through the way we form them and educate them and shape them and love them. I don't know if people took the time to read the quote on the front of the bulletin this morning. It's longer than usual. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hope of its children. This is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the clouds of war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron. Not an 8th century BC prophet, not some hippie flower child, but General of the Army Dwight D. Eisenhower. Here is a man who knew something of war. Here is a man who saw a different possibility. What about you? What about me? What can we see? What can we do?